Media Masters presents Clifford Bourne with the pet secrets of professional storytellers. Here's how to create stories to hook and hold your audiences.
An encyclopedia of murderers wouldn't be complete without King David, writer of some of the most beautiful psalms in the Bible. David murdered one of his fighting men, Uriah. He had him killed by ordering him to the front line of battle without defence or way of escape. Why? Because King David had been to bed with Uriah's wife, and she was now pregnant. The Lord gave the prophet Nathan the task of making David face up to his crimes. How do you tell a king that he's an adulterer and a murderer and order him to repent? It was an explosive situation, a dangerous assignment. So Nathan planned some spiritual strategy. He told the king a story. He told the writer of the 23rd Psalm a sheep story. There were two men in a city, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had very many herds and flocks, but the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb. He had bought it and brought it up, and it grew up with him and his children. The family loved it. Now a traveller came to the rich man, and to avoid taking one of his own flock to prepare for his guest, he took the poor man's lamb, killed it, and served it. The story angered David. He brought his fist down on the arm of the throne and thundered, "The man who has done this deserves to die." And Nathan nodded, "He does deserve to die, and you are that man." Stung by the truth, the king sank back on the throne. Nathan then told him of God's judgment. That's the story behind the 51st Psalm, David's Psalm, which begins, "Have mercy upon me, O God, according to your steadfast love." Nathan struck hard at the king's conscience and brought his message home using a simple story. Spiritual strategy. Why? Men are on guard when you denounce or condemn them. But whoever guards himself against a story? A story with a hidden meaning is like an operation under anaesthetic. The work is done while the patient isn't conscious of it. The story always has been, and always will be, the teacher's most effective means of communicating with people. Professional communicators use stories to grab and grip audiences, to sell their ideas or products, to make their meaning clear, or to inspire people to action. Why? They'll give you many good reasons. First and foremost, they obey the communicator's golden rule. Give your audience the message you want, but package it the way they want. How do people prefer that you package your message? In story form. People crave stories. Is crave too strong a word? Consider that children spend a total time of over one day a week watching stories on TV. At the time a teenager leaves high school, the teenager has watched 22,000 hours of television programs and seen over 500 feature-length movies. The average televiewer at 60 years of age has spent 9 years of life in front of a television set, watching stories. And then there's gossip. You know the girl in the church fellowship who says, "I don't believe in saying anything about a person unless it's good, and boy, is this good." Communicators who aim to please audiences use stories because people want and enjoy them. Why are people drawn to stories? People like stories because they believe their own lives are boring and unexciting. Through a story, they can identify with the main character and live with that character as that character struggles to overcome some intolerable situation in life. They like to identify with a fighter. They want to empathize with someone who dares and wins. I was standing in a bookstore next to a little old lady who was waiting to pay her annual subscription to a magazine, Wildlife. She stood there with a basket under one arm and a small black poodle under the other. As the shop assistants weren't noticing her, she announced in a loud voice, "I'm waiting to pay for my Wildlife." I leant close and whispered, "Well, we all have to sooner or later." She gave me a sad smile and sighed, "If only it had been." Yes, most people believe their lives are dull. There was once a conference of authors who write sex and aggression paperbacks. They're the thrillers on the bookstand which put a pretty girl on the cover without putting a cover on the pretty girl. She's usually accompanied by a knife or a gun. Writers ask these best-selling authors how they saw their market audience. The authors agreed, "We see the readers of our books as having three major experiences in life: work, sleep, and worry. If they have a fourth major experience, it's loneliness. A city has millions of people all being lonely together. If they have a fifth experience, it's frustration. Work, sleep, worry, loneliness, and frustration. Not a pleasant picture of life, but real reasons why people like to escape from reality into a world of fiction. Another reason why people enjoy stories is they like to play God. They observe the characters in the story and pass judgment on them. While your family watch television, listen to the way they critically appraise the characters. Dad complains, "What a stupid detective. Blind Freddy could have solved the case by now. I wish he'd hurry up and get on with it." And Mum comments, "Why does that girl wear such funny clothes? Young people dress up in some weird things these days," and so on. You know, actors rarely have a kind word for critics. They say, "A critic is given a free seat, the best in the theatre, but he prefers to sit on the play, the cast, the production, and the writer." When it comes to television, we're all critics. We enjoy judging. We like to play God. It's the same at sporting events. Go to a football game and listen to the gods as they shout their verdicts on the players, the teams, and the referees. An important reason why people enjoy stories is that they want to know how to cope with life's problems. They watch the story characters deal with dangers which threaten their lives. They decide what behaviour to copy and what behaviour to avoid. Life is full of difficulties and opposition. Life is struggle. Life is a succession of laughter, tears, smiles, and sniffles. But the greatest of these is sniffles. People want to know how to live life victoriously. They look to stories for answers. If the audience prefers to learn through stories, then wise communicators give them what they want. As well, communicators know that stories can help a teacher achieve three desired goals. The teacher wants people to understand certain ideas, to believe those ideas, and remember them. Audiences will never put your ideas into practice unless they understand, believe, and remember them. A story helps people understand an idea when it turns their ears into eyes and shows them the idea in action. A story helps people believe an idea when it demonstrates a convincing case history of a character who practiced the idea or who foolishly ignored the idea. If you want people to understand and believe your ideas, then illustrate them with a story. Aristotle taught his students, "The information we remember longest is the information we received packaged in a most striking circumstance." A story is a striking circumstance. If you want people to remember your ideas, then illustrate them with a story. Any teaching tool which can help the audience understand, believe, and remember is indispensable to a communicator. Yes, the story can do even more for you. Stories can give speakers the valuable addition of audience participation. You might protest, hey, hold on, audience participation? Where's the audience participation when people are listening to a story? They just sit there like a group in a photograph. They look passive, not active. Never mind how they look. Realize what's going on inside them. Inside each listener, the story starts two things working. It activates their imagination and emotions. Imagination enables the listener to see the story in the cinema of the mind. In Singapore, a Chinese university student listened as I told the story of Roman Governor Pontius Pilate cross-examining Jesus and ordering his execution. Then followed the crucifixion at Calvary. This Chinese Christian, young in faith, told me afterwards, I saw it all. I saw it all. His imagination pictured the story for him. An Australian grandmother listened to the story of Jesus healing the 10 lepers. She wanted to assure me, oh, it was vivid. I felt I was there. Her imagination pictured the story for her. The storyteller does more than tell a story. The storyteller tells the story to an audience. The audience imagines what happens, and through the listener's imagination, the speaker gets audience participation. Imagination helps the storyteller grab and grip audience attention. The most powerful influence a story has over an audience is producing emotions in them. When you arouse emotions in an audience, they experience an illusion of sharing the dramatic situation. Indeed, they crave that illusion. That's what millions of moviegoers pay for. They pay to feel, to participate emotionally. They don't go to see actors perform. They go to slip into the skin of the main character and experience his tension as he struggles to solve his problem and his elation if he succeeds. Audiences want a barrack. So the storyteller shows them a person in crisis. They care about this character. Emotionally, they identify with that person to the point where they feel they have a stake in the results. Produce feelings in your audience and they will pay attention, suspend disbelief or disagreement, consider your idea, and remember it. And often they'll repeat it to others. Fail to produce feelings in your audience and you bore them. They lose interest, their attention wanders, and they forget what you told them. If you want people to listen to and realize the truth in what you say, then make them feel. Audiences learn through feelings. Use the beginning of the story to create tension in them. Use the middle of the story to increase that tension. Use the climax to focus tension and the resolution to release tension. What does an audience want? Pleasurable tension followed by a joyous release. So, stimulate and satisfy. A story is a plan for producing emotions in an audience. The storyteller decides how he wants them to react, then plans the story to arouse those predetermined feelings. And what a variety of feelings please them. They like stories which stir their curiosity, tickle their sense of humour, or make them shudder. They feel satisfied when a story reaffirms a truth of vital importance to living. They're glad when a likeable main character solves a problem or achieves a purpose. They're pleased when wrongdoers are defeated or punished. Audiences care, fear, hate, admire, grieve, or rejoice. The wise storyteller constructs the story so that the audience will experience the emotions the storyteller wants them to feel. So, how do stories reward communicators? 1. Stories fascinate people. People prefer to learn through stories. They like to identify with a winner. They like to judge and they want to know how to cope with life's problems. 2. Your stories help people understand your ideas, believe your ideas, and remember your ideas. 3. Your stories produce audience participation. They bring to life each listener's imagination and emotions. A story is a plan to produce emotions in an audience. The late great Professor C.S. Lewis wrote, "If you have something important to say, a story is the best way to say it." Storytelling is like parking a car. Some find it difficult, others put it over with a bang. Well, here's everything you need to know to put it over with a bang. The greatest part of a storyteller's work is the preparation of the story. A story well prepared is 90% given. All you have to do is to stand up and tell it. Many people can tell stories, few can prepare and write them. Yet story writing isn't so difficult when you know how. Now this tape is full of techniques used by top writers and storytellers. They're easy to learn and they'll really work for you. Professional performers use these clues in every form of show business. Some use them to entertain, some to sell products or ideas, others to teach. Some use them because they believe laughter is the best medicine, and others use them because they believe art is a weapon. People enjoy seeing a person in trouble and watching how the person deals with it. Whether Romans feed Christians to lions, mobs watch prize fights, or audiences laugh or cry over films or television plays, all the world loves a fighter. Audiences identify with a hero and want the hero to win the cause. A husband came home from work and his wife asked, "Well, are we going to the movies tonight?" He said, "No, dear, I'm too tired. I think I'll let Clint Eastwood shoot it out on his own tonight." That gag from a radio show raised a laugh from many sympathetic fellows who enjoy detective stories. They identify with the main character in the film and live with him through his moments of difficulty and danger until he biffs the baddies, grabs the girl, and leaves with the loot. The entertainment business is mostly built on this fact. Watching someone face trouble fascinates people. That's why we like stories. For a story is what happens when a person has a problem and deals with it. A story must have a person with a problem. One main character who solves one main problem. Unless you have a person with a problem, what you write or tell might be a good joke, incident, character study or description, but it's not a story. You can't break this basic rule without spoiling your story. Use only one main character with one main problem. Any other characters or problems are there only if they have bearing upon the main character solving his or her problem. Let the main character solve the problem themselves. Don't bring in the United States cavalry to save them at the last moment. Audiences rarely forgive that sort of thing. They want their main characters to solve their problems through their own thought, strength, or ingenuity. There are three types of story. They're easy to recognize. Learn to identify them and you'll save much time when story writing or adapting. First, there's the accomplishment story. A person struggles to solve a problem or achieve a purpose. Accomplishment stories are popular with audiences of all ages. They like to see someone struggle against strong opposition and get what he wants. David's struggle to bring down the Philistine giant is an accomplishment story. So is Nehemiah's struggle to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. When the explorer sets out to find the lost city, when the Mountie rides off to get his man, when the cop starts to work out who done it, there's an accomplishment story. So accomplishment stories show a main character struggling to overcome all opposition until he gets what he wants. The second type of story is the decision story. A person struggles with forces for and against which influence his decision. The classic case here is the Roman governor Pontius Pilate. He poses his own dramatic problem, "And what shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?" In the end, he alone has to make the decision to execute Jesus. When a judge has to decide guilty or not guilty, when the girl must choose between the rich old man and the poor young man, when the hero chooses between liberty and death, there's a decision story. Decision stories show a main character struggling to make up his mind. The third type is the theme story. A person struggles to realize a truth of vital importance to living. King Midas wished that everything he touched would turn to gold. He got his wish. Then he kissed his little daughter and took a mouthful of hot food. A sad, sorry king learned that gold isn't everything. When a man realizes that you must look before you elope, when someone learns that he who hesitates gets bumped in the rear, there's a theme story. When you write a theme story, make sure that the truth the main character realizes is of vital importance. If the lesson is obvious, the audience yawns and says, "So what?" There you have the three story types: accomplishment, decision, and theme. There aren't any new plots, just old plots told in new ways. Examine every story you see and hear. Learn to identify what type of story it is. When you prepare a story, know what type of story you're writing. Films or plays may have two or more storylines which overlap. The musical play My Fair Lady has an accomplishment story and a theme story. In the first story, Professor Higgins struggles to present the Cockney flower seller, Eliza Doolittle, as a princess at a society ball. He achieves his purpose. Then the plot focuses on the theme story. Professor Higgins struggles to realize that he can't live without Eliza. He learns this as he sings, "I've grown accustomed to her face." So the play has two stories. The main character struggles to achieve a purpose. Then he struggles to realize a truth of vital importance to his living. The stage show allows him a couple of hours to do all this. The stories you tell take about 10 to 15 minutes. In this time, stick to the rule of good short story writing: only one main character with one main problem. That's all there's time for. The other day I got into a taxi to go to a television production. The cab driver grinned and asked, "Hey, remember me?" I didn't, so he went on. "You were in this cab 6 months ago. I asked you what you did for a living, and you said you were a scriptwriter. So I asked you to settle an argument I had with my missus. She said people are born with the ability to write. I said they have to be taught. So I asked you, are writers born, or do they learn it all? And you said there was a lot to learn, and you gave me an example. You said there were three types of story: accomplishment, decision, and theme. Right?"
"Right. You have a good memory. They're the three types."
"I know. Do you know how I remember them? Every night when the two of us watch telly, we have a competition. We look at each movie and work out which kind of story it is. If the boy's searching for a missing witness to save his girlfriend from going to the electric chair, then we know it's an accomplishment story, right?" At first my missus thought I was kidding her, but then she caught on, and now she's better at it than I am. Once in a while she'll even work out the end of the story before it finishes. Well now, I'm ready for the next lesson. What's next?"
What's next is the most exciting part of story writing. But before you begin the next chapter, resolve to do what the cabbie did. From now on, examine every story you see and hear. Recognize what type of story it is. This is the first step to becoming a good story writer. remember the songs I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy and Give My Regards to Broadway? They're from successful musical comedies written years ago by George M. Cohan. Cohan had a simple format for all his stage shows. Act 1, get the hero up a tree. Act 2, throw rocks at him. Act 3, get him out of the tree. In other words, put the main character in a difficult situation and let's watch him fight his way out. Storytellers call the main character's hard fight to solve a problem the conflict. Conflict is the essential ingredient in any story. If you don't have conflict, you don't have a story. If you don't have conflict, you won't have an audience either. People are only interested in seeing your main character solve the problem, reach the decision, or realize some vital truth if the main character has to fight against strong opposition to do it. Here's a favorite format of magazine story writers. 1. Make the readers like a character. 2. Make the character want something. 3. Put difficulties in the character's way. 4. Show how the character overcomes the difficulties. What's the most important part of the format? Put difficulties in the character's way and show how the character overcomes them. Let's see the main character fight to get what the main character wants. Maximum desire set against maximum opposition gives you maximum drama. A writer was upset because every time he sent a story to an editor, it came back with a note, "More conflict, more conflict." Finally, the writer asked the editor, "Okay, you give me a good example of conflict." "Well," said the editor, "there are two guys, see? Two guys. One wants to be a jet pilot, and the other wants to be a deep-sea diver. And they're Siamese twins. Now there's conflict." Conflict is the heartbeat of a story. Stories just can't do without it. Conflict comes in many forms. Let's look at some of them. The first basic conflict is man against man. When two strong, intelligent fighters face each other, the crowd gets excited. Here's conflict. The conflict grows with each attack and counterattack until one of the fighters defeats the other. This type of conflict is the backbone of stories where men compete for money, power, a girl, or some other girl. The main character wants the money, power, position, or girl, and someone stands in the way. He has to overcome that person to get what he wants. Many old Hollywood movies used it in that format. Boy meets girl and falls in love. Villain pushes aside boy and takes girl. Boy takes courage and defeats villain. Boy and girl walk off into the setting sun. Does all that sound familiar? By the way, it's the format of most of the Popeye the Sailor cartoons. Next time you see a Popeye cartoon on TV, you'll find Popeye meets Olive Oil and falls in love with her. Big tough villain steps in, beats up Popeye and takes Olive Oil. Popeye eats his spinach. Then, with super strength, he flattens the villain. Popeye and Olive Oil then sail off into the sunset. The conflict of man against man includes the struggle between man and woman, father and son, mother-in-law and son-in-law, or any combination of people. It can be the struggle of one man against a group. When you write of conflict between people, make sure opponents are evenly matched. Who wants to watch a fight between a strong man and a weakling? We know what the outcome will be. You'll capture our interest when you present two enemies well matched in a fight, where neither can nor will give in until the other is defeated. Another basic conflict is between man and his conscience. This is man's mental struggle with himself. A man learns and believes certain principles which guide the way he behaves. When he's forced to act in a way contrary to those principles, there's the conflict of man against his conscience. Yet another basic conflict is man's struggle against the forces of nature. You find it in stories where man fights to survive in the scorching heat of the desert or the freezing cold of icy wastelands. Sailors fighting stormy seas, farmers struggling against drought, all tell of man's continuing battle with the elements. Often, storytellers combine the conflict of man against nature with the conflict of man against man or man against his conscience. This example really happened. The Indian teacher Sundar Singh trudged his way through a snowy blizzard in the mountains of Tibet. He met another traveller, and together they plodded on until they found another man who'd collapsed in the snow. He was exhausted, he couldn't walk, but he was alive. Sundar Singh wanted to stop and pick up the sick man. His companion refused. "We're going to be lucky to get to a village as we are. Carrying him would slow us down completely. Look at him, he's almost dead. Don't be a fool. If you carry him, it won't be long before you're in the same state he is. Come on, keep moving." Now, up till now, it's been a story of man against the forces of nature. Sundar Singh has been fighting his way to safety against bad weather. Now comes a struggle with his conscience. Sundar Singh believed his companion was right. There was little hope of reaching safety on his own. He needed all his energy for himself. Weighed down with the body of the sick man, it seemed unlikely he could reach safety. His companion gave him a last urgent plea to keep moving and walked on. The sick man groaned. Sundar Singh lived his life in obedience to a lord who said, "Treat others exactly the way you like to be treated. Love others as I have loved you." To obey Jesus could cost him his life. He knelt in the snow, lifted the man onto his back, and staggered to his feet. Slowly he started a perilous journey to find safety. As he gasped for breath, struggled for footholds, how many times did Sundar Singh's aching limbs tell him to drop his burden? What happened? Well, they both lived to tell the story. They were saved by their body heat keeping them warm and alive. The other traveller was found dead in the snow. He wanted to save his life and lost it. Sundar Singh, willing to lose his life, saved it. Other forms of conflict are man against God. "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? Let my people go." Then you have man against tradition and man against beast. There's also beast against beast. Strong conflict makes powerful stories which hold audiences. When you prepare a story, there are two things you need to know. One, what does the main character want? Two, who or what stops the main character from getting it? Answer the second question, and you've identified the conflict. Then build this conflict as the opponents attack and counterattack until at the climax, one wins. The climax of a story is the defeat of one of the opposing forces. It doesn't always leave everybody living happily ever after. I think the best finish to a story I ever read came from a little boy writing a school story. He finished, "He said, 'Will you marry me?' She said, 'No,' and they both lived happily ever after." Now, in your story, the climax doesn't always leave everybody living happily ever after. It only settles the matter in hand. When you've answered these questions, you can start constructing your story. Who's your main character? What does the main character want? Who or what stops main character from getting it? What does main character do about these difficulties, this opposition? What happens as a result of the action? What final showdown does this lead to? And does main character finally get what the main character wants? Listening to a story without conflict is like watching one wrestler. There's nothing happening to interest us. Conflict is the essential ingredient. Scriptwriters have long learned, no clash, no cash.
I'll never forget the time I saw Jungle Dr. Paul White tell a class of teenagers his fable about a monkey caught in a swamp. The monkey makes every effort to escape, but slowly sinks deeper into the mud. There was neither sound nor movement from the young audience. All eyes were on the storyteller. Surely the monkey would escape. His monkey mind must think of a way. The mud rose, and the audience worried. They hoped he'd escape. They wanted him to escape. But how?
It's strange but true that audiences enjoy themselves when they worry. They worry whether the main character will solve the problem or not. This state of worry, which so holds their attention, is called suspense. The sooner you create suspense in a story, the better. Once you create it, hold it and increase it until the story reaches its climax.
Film director Alfred Hitchcock made movies that filled audiences with suspense. An airport officer once examined Hitchcock's passport. He inquired, "It says here that your occupation is a producer. What do you produce?"
The master storyteller leaned towards him and whispered, "Goose pimples." He knew his craft and achieved his purpose, creating suspense in the audience.
Writers create suspense when the main character, while trying to solve the problem, meets difficulties, that is, obstacles, complications, or opposition. When difficulties arise, the audience hopes the main character will solve the problem, but fear the main character may not. Hope plus fear equals doubt, and doubt produces worry.
You can increase the suspense by imposing certain limits on the character solving the problem. First, there's the time limit. In Jungle Doctor's Hippo Happenings, the small antelope falls into a trap. The hunter made this deep, dark pit so that the unfortunate victim couldn't escape. The antelope tries every way possible to get out of the trap. He fails. Boo-hoo, the unhappy hippopotamus, gives him advice, and Toto the monkey tries to help him. They don't succeed either. As the antelope thinks of each new idea, he tries it and fails. Difficulties create suspense, and the suspense is increased by a time limit for escape. If the antelope isn't out of the trap by sundown, the hunter will come back to kill whatever he finds there. The time limit gives the problem urgency, and that increases suspense in the audience. Another limitation to add suspense is limited possible solutions to the problem. When the main character is isolated, cut off from all other help, thrown upon his own resources, with limited possible ways of solving the problem, then audiences worry. Many storytellers use our common fears to stimulate suspense. Our fear of heights is played upon so often when the hero and villain fight on top of castles or cliffs. Our fear of confined spaces arouses suspense when the hero is trapped underground or has to tunnel his way to safety. We have an instinctive dread of many things. Good storytellers know our fears and use this knowledge when creating suspenseful situations. Another suspense trick is to take something which is normally pleasant and make it an unexpected menace. The characters in the story believe the object is harmless. The audience know the object is deadly. The villain sets a booby trap in a birthday cake. When the hero plunges a knife into the cake, it will blow him to bits. Suspense rises each time the cake is touched or moved. When the hero picks up the knife to cut the cake, the audience holds its breath. In some stories, what looks pleasant but is really dangerous is not an object but a person. Remember that scene in the bedroom when Little Red Riding Hood thought she was talking to her dear old grandma, and all the time you knew it was that hungry wolf in disguise? The film The Bad Seed is a murder story. One character is a 12-year-old girl. She is beautiful and shy. People try to shield her from the tragic events happening in the neighbourhood. They don't know that she is the murderer. This child plans an accidental death for anyone who opposes her. Much of the suspense in the story comes from the characters not knowing the real nature of the murderous young miss. Do you want to keep your audiences listening? Then make them worry. Years ago, when my son Christopher was small, when he was late to watch a television film, he'd ask those already watching one question. Who are the goodies and who are the baddies? Once he had this information, Christopher sat back and enjoyed the story. Children's stories seem to have only two types of people, goodies or baddies. The characters are uncomplicated. Heroines are virtually good and villains are thoroughly evil. Real people aren't like that. Teacher asked, Willie, if good children were green and bad children were red, what colour would you be? Willie grinned and said, I'd be streaky. That goes for most of us. There are many sides to each character. Storytellers must know their characters. How each character looks, age, height, weight, colour of hair, skin, eyes, defects. The character's background, class, occupation, education, home life, religion, race, place in the community, political affiliations, amusements. The character's moral standards, ambitions, frustrations, temperament, attitudes to life, complexes, abilities, qualities, IQ. A storyteller mightn't like a character, but the storyteller must know that character. The character's physiology, sociology, and psychology. A writer sent a story to an editor with this footnote. Any resemblance between the characters in this story and living people is purely coincidental. The editor returned the story with a note, and that's what's wrong with it. If you're to create and present real people in your stories, then you need to know everything about them. You won't share all that information with the audience. In short stories, there isn't time, and it isn't needed. Audiences don't want lengthy descriptions of characters. It slows down the plot. Their interest is in that part of the character important to the story. So characters in short stories are kept simple. How can you save time describing characters? How can you present characters people can see? Some writers use the quick, easy way of comparing people to animals. Call a man a pig or a donkey, and everybody knows the kind of man he is. Jesus called the sly, cunning King Herod the fox. The beautiful, treacherous Delilah has been likened to a cat, graceful, with sharp teeth and claws. The best way to bring characters to life is by using dialogue. When characters speak, characters reveal themselves. What a character says and how the character says it tell us so much about the character. Good or bad grammar. Simple or complex sentences, slang, clichés or technical terms, dialect or accent, a voice weak or strong, a voice gentle or coarse, a manner pompous, cynical or apologetic. These things show immediately the kind of person speaking. Speech tells us about the speaker. It can also tell us about the person spoken to. The speaker's tone may be respectful, rude, impatient, or sarcastic. From this we learn the speaker's attitude or relationship to the other character. So let characters speak for themselves, and you won't have to waste time describing them. Alfred Hitchcock said, "The drama is life with the dull bits left out." If that's so, then dialogue is conversation with the dull bits left out. If drama is life condensed and highlighted, then dialogue is conversation condensed and highlighted. A dialogue's purpose is to give information about plot and character. Every line must carry the plot forward or tell something important about the characters. Cut out any lines which don't do this. They aren't needed. Dialogue may reveal information and yet be dull and uninteresting. If it's to hold an audience's attention, then it must be charged with emotion. Characters must feel strongly about what they say. It's their enthusiasm, bitterness, resentment, and other emotions which make audiences sit up and listen. If you want to save time describing people, if you want characters to come to life, if you want the story to move, if you want audiences to sit up and listen, use dialogue which reveals information about plot and character with emotion. It's difficult to get emotive dialogue between characters who have the same outlook on life or the same temperament. For exciting dialogue, you need contrasting characters. When planning characters, give them different temperaments. Characters with opposite natures and opposing viewpoints will cause conflict and give your dialogue emotion. One reason why children like Jungle Doctor's fables is the cast of contrasting characters. They're easy to imagine and remember. Boo-hoo, the unhappy hippopotamus, has a soft heart and a head to match. In a battle of wits, he's completely unarmed. Big body, little brain, and heart of gold. That's Boo-hoo. Toto the monkey is an appetite surrounded by fur. Monkey mischief lands him in trouble. Monkey wisdom should save him. It only gets him into worse trouble. Tembo the elephant is strong and gentle. He's in command of every situation. Elephant knows the jungle and every creature in it. He defends the weak and defeats the wicked. Mbisi the hyena is thoroughly unpleasant. A dishonest, untruthful troublemaker. There are also Twiga, the kindly giraffe, Faru, the bad-tempered rhinoceros, and Toto's uncle Nyani and his jabbering relations. Put those characters together and something must happen. There will be plenty of conflict and lively dialogue. The leopard boasted that he was the fastest animal in the jungle. Elephant grinned.
I don't believe you're fast enough to catch a monkey.
Show me the monkey, and I'll show you how fast I am, growled the spotted one.
Elephant reached into the treetop with his trunk and lifted a small monkey from a branch. Leopard followed him as he carried the little monkey 50 yards away from the tree. All the time, Elephant was talking to the little fellow.
This leopard, this spotted pussycat, says he's faster than all of us. I don't think he can run as fast as you can. I want you to race him, and I want you to win. If you don't, and he catches you...
Gently, he placed the monkey on the ground, raised his trunk and trumpeted,
Now!
Monkey ran for the tree faster than his legs had ever carried him. Leopard leapt after him, a whirlwind of tooth and claw and deadly power. Monkey reached the tree first. He shot up the trunk and out on a limb. It was a thin limb which wouldn't take the weight of a leopard. Leopard came close behind him. He stopped in the fork of the tree when he saw how dangerously thin was the branch where the monkey clung.
Elephant lifted his trunk and laughed.
So leopards are faster than monkeys, eh?
And the leopard snarled. Well, I was running to prove a point. He was running to save his life. Yes, and the motive behind the action made all the difference to the performance. This brings us to the most important part of characterization. Motivation. Why do the characters in your story act and react the way they do? Every human action has a reason. We eat because we're hungry. We drink because we're thirsty. We rest because we're tired. Physical drives of hunger, thirst, sex, and the need for shelter or clothing affect us all. As well, we have social drives like love, hate, fear, worry, pride, ambition. Storytellers must know why every character behaves as that character does. These reasons must be made clear to the audience. All motives must be clear, they must be strong, they must be convincing. If any character changes, make sure the audience knows what causes the change. If the coward becomes brave, the miser becomes generous, or the unbeliever finds faith, these unexpected changes of character must be carefully motivated. If they aren't, no one will believe the story. Good stories are plausible. The best help to plausibility is right motivation. If you read and tell Bible stories, get into the habit of looking for the reasons behind everything the characters say and do. A man asks Jesus a question. Why? What answer does he expect? Why? What answer does Jesus give? Why? How does the man react to Jesus' answer? Why? The motives aren't always obvious. Sometimes you'll have to do some thinking. Sometimes you'll need to do research. What petrol is to a car, motive is to a character. It makes him get up and go. What impels the characters in your story to act as they do? This is a question to which you must give the audience a proper answer. Teachers are sometimes concerned about storytellers using their imaginations when telling Bible stories. Here are three guidelines to protect plot, character, and truth. Whatever you add to the Bible account must be true to background, true to character, and true to the spirit of God's word. First, true to background. Bible storytellers need to learn about the customs and cultures of their story situations. The story happens in a geographical and historic setting. The religious beliefs and politics of the time may have important information to help us understand the characters and their predicament. Next, whatever you add needs to be true to character. Learn all you can about your character from preceding incidents and or from other gospel accounts of the story. Let's take a simple example. Simon Peter, the big fisherman, would make himself heard above wind and wave as he called to his men and to the other men in other boats. Big man, big voice. Peter was impetuous. If something was on his mind, it was soon on his tongue. He spoke to you with all the bluntness of a blood relation. Who else would dare criticize and rebuke Jesus? Now Joseph of Arimathea was a member of the Jewish ruling council. Rich, educated, reserved. He was a secret disciple of Jesus because he feared the religious authorities. His voice would be soft and refined. It would not be true to character to give Simon Peter a quiet, timid voice. And it would not be true to character to give Joseph of Arimathea a voice that was loud and boisterous. So whatever you add must be true to the personality, speech patterns, and behaviour of each character. Then, whatever you add must be true to the spirit of God's word. The task for the Bible story writer is to understand what the Spirit of God is saying through the original text and communicate it. Why did the Bible writer write this particular story? To whom did he write? What was he teaching? What did he want the reader to understand, believe, or do having read the story? Teachers and preachers often use Bible stories to illustrate ideas which they want to teach, ideas which were not intended by the author. For example, the preacher who tells the story of the Good Samaritan saying, "A certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho. Like him, we all take a downward path in life. And he fell among thieves who beat him up, robbed him, stripped him, and left him to die in the dirt. The three great enemies who assault us on life's journey are the world, the flesh, and the devil. It so happened that a priest came that way, saw him, and passed by on the other side. A church official did nothing to help him. And then a Levite, a Bible scholar, passed him by also. Last of all came a Samaritan, and he had compassion on him. The Lord Jesus sees people beaten and robbed by the world, the flesh, and the devil, and he has compassion on them," etc., etc., etc. Was that what Jesus was trying to teach the lawyer when he told him that story? Was that Luke's purpose in recording the story? Is all that true to the spirit of God's word? If whatever the story writer adds is true to background, true to character, and true to the spirit of God's word, then Scripture will not be distorted, and nothing has to be unlearned. Here's another important tip. Never, and that means don't ever, make Jesus the main character in your story. You can see why when you understand the work of the story's main character. It's through the main character that the story writer manipulates the emotions of the audience. To participate in a story and enjoy it, the audience empathizes with the main character. Not sympathize, empathize. They identify themselves with the main character. Through their imaginations and their emotions, they slip into that character's skin. They adopt the character's viewpoint. As the character hopes, they hope. As the character fears, they fear. They experience the story through self-identification. Now, Jesus, who has the nature of God and the nature of man, is someone with whom it's impossible to identify. We can't slip into his skin and know how he felt and precisely what he thought. Filmmakers and playwrights know this. The author Michael Green told me he once dined with Andrew Lloyd Webber and Timothy Rice after they wrote the musical Jesus Christ Superstar. Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice told him that the Jesus in their musical play Jesus Christ Superstar is not the Jesus of the New Testament. They looked at the gospel accounts and they couldn't understand the character. They knew that the audience could not understand the character and identify that character unless they changed the character. So they made up their own Jesus based on incidents within the gospel. So, in stories from the gospel, who makes the best main character? The answer is anyone who reacts or responds to Jesus. The German theologian Helmut Tiedeke says, "The best way to see Jesus is to stand in the shoes of someone who responded to him." So we tell stories of Peter and John, of blind Bartimaeus and Zacchaeus, of Mary and Martha and others. As these characters respond to Jesus in faith, love, and obedience, the audience identifies with them and wants to respond to him in the same way. So, each story is about a main character who responds to Jesus. Once a man full of that dreaded disease of leprosy came to Jesus. The poor, pitiful wretch, covered with filthy bandages, fell on his knees before Jesus and cried, "Oh Lord, Lord, if only you want to, you can make me clean." Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him. He touched him and said, "Of course I want to. You be clean." And immediately the leprosy left him. It's interesting to note that the leper didn't doubt Jesus' power to heal, only Jesus' willingness. Why was he so sure that Jesus could deal with his situation? Most likely because a person who had every confidence in Jesus had told him with great conviction what Jesus can do. I don't believe people will seek Jesus as Savior and Lord until those who know Jesus tell them with confidence of his power, goodness, and love. Those who have the responsibility of teaching the faith as well as living the faith find storytelling a great help in telling others about Jesus. What a privilege and joy it is to bring life to the gospel stories so that people can see Jesus, his wisdom, compassion, power, and love. For when they see who he is and what he can do, people are more likely to seek him. So you want to tell stories? Then master these mechanics and develop the art. To develop the art, you practice, you tell stories, and you tell them again. As an Irish storyteller put it, storytelling's easy if you work hard enough at it. I'm glad you listened to this tape. If you understood it, I'm pleased. If you learned something from it, I'm delighted. But what's most important is doing something with what you learned. Do you agree?
We invite you to enjoy another tape in our speech communication series. Clifford Warne teaches The Art of Reading Aloud. The Art of Reading Aloud tells how to read the Bible aloud, sound natural, and make the meaning clear. The Art of Reading Aloud for Bible Readers, a Media Masters production.